Hi, everybody. Welcome. What a wonderful crowd. And it's wonderful to also know that there is what's now it's not a particularly dignified name, but we have an overflow room tonight, which I think is splendid. It just tells you how important we all regard the issues that are going to be addressed tonight. So on behalf of the Canadian Journalism Foundation, I'd like to welcome you here. The JTalks explore the ongoing challenges shaping journalism, and tonight our discussion will address those challenges very directly. For that, we have to thank the Public Policy Forum, our partner for this event, and the one responsible for the major study on news media released today, which looks at how major shifts are affecting the health of Canadian democracy, whether it's the decline of the traditional media's business model or the rise of fake news. We also thank Earnscliff Strategy Group for conducting the public opinion study on Canadians' attitudes towards the media and the future of news organizations. We also have to thank those who make our events possible. BMO Financial Group, our JTalk series sponsor, and CNW, our in-kind supporter. Thanks as well to Global News tonight for providing the broadcast to the Overflow Room. Note to me here, Global is not broadcasting anywhere else. Just so you know, you're not going to go home and see this on reruns. I would like to thank, if you would like to join tonight's conversation on Twitter, you can use the hashtag CJFJTalk. Moderating our discussion tonight, Christopher Waddell, who is the associate professor at the School of Journalism and Communication at Carleton University and a member of the CJF board, heading a couple of our most important committees. We're glad to have with us tonight Ed Greenspan, president and CEO of Public Policy Forum, Alan Gregg, principal with Earnscliff Strategy Group, and April Lindgren, associate professor at Ryerson University School of Journalism and principal investigator for the Local News Research Project. Please join me in welcoming our speakers tonight.
Thanks very much, John. What we're going to do this evening is I'm going to speak with Ed, ask him a few questions about the report. Some of you may have read the report. It's been out since this morning. There are a few copies here that people can pick up later on, but there's not too many. It's mostly online, and you can download it online. Ed can tell you the actual address.
www.shatteredmirror.ca or on the Public Policy Forum website, which is ppforum.ca.
Very good. And then Alan is, after that, Alan's going to talk about the public opinion research that that was done as part of this program. And the Canadian Journalism Foundation was part of that, along with the Public Policy Forum. And then April and I are going to talk for a little bit about her research as it relates to local news, which is, if you read the report, you'll find April is quoted in the report. And she's also involved in research projects involving local news across the country, and will give everyone a little bit of a sense about that. And then we also want to have time for everyone to ask questions, and we'll have a microphone back at the back. People can ask questions, that, and we'll try to wrap up by about 7:30, so that should be about 90 minutes or so. So if we get close to 7:30 and there's a couple of people still in the line, we may let them ask questions, but we're going to try and be pretty rigid on that, because we'll have a little reception afterwards. You can come up and speak with our guests at that point. But let me start out by speaking with Ed for a couple of minutes and ask him if he could begin by taking us through a little bit of his thinking and the Public Policy Forum's thinking as this project evolved from what you thought it was going to be when it started out to what it ended up being when it actually was published today. Right. And how did that evolve?
Okay, well, I'd say thanks, Chris, and I also want to thank CJF for support with the poll and for tonight's event. So I got a call originally from somebody in the government in mid to late February saying that and it was a friend of mine, somebody that I knew pretty well, saying that, we're apprehensive that we may be called upon to make public policy in this area of the news, and we really don't have much expertise around news. If this was shipbuilding or, he said, or music or film or industries like that, we got people to know it, but we purposely have stayed away from news. And really the initial conversation, I had not yet announced, I was still at Bloomberg and I was going to the Public Policy Forum, but I had not yet announced that, and he just as a friend wanted to know my view. And in that first conversation I said, I really don't think that the government of Canada or the public interest lies in you know, saving business models that may be old and may not be necessary. The government of Canada's interest lies in ensuring that the democracy will be well functioned. Now, maybe that will circle you back to different models of journalism, different platforms, et cetera, but democracy is the point. So the broad strokes of that remain throughout the piece. Underneath that, you know, I've been in the industry a long time, and I've had the, you know, good fortune to be, you know, both a reporter and to be, you know, in senior executive position. So I've seen numbers, I've seen, you know, real numbers of how things look, and there were shocking things to me. Shocking to me that in 10 years there hasn't been an iota of growth in digital revenues for newspaper companies. Yeah, so for a while that was one of the great hopes that would replace it. And it stayed flatlined at $230 to $240 million while the market went from under $1 billion to over $5 billion. So that was shocking. Shocking to me to see that two platform companies, the king of search, Google, and the king of social, Facebook, who have had, you know, excellent business models and are obviously respected by customers and have just been, you know, smart and good operators in the market, but that they would have 82.4% of the digital ads, that of 4.7 billion digital ad impressions that were served up in one quarter in 2016, that 82.4% of them went to two companies, and that all of the people who actually produced journalism, the publishers and the broadcasters, would have 11.5%, you know, in the marketplace of ideas, that's a problem. There's nothing wrong of it in the economic marketplace. They've, you know, they've won fair and square. In the marketplace of the ideas, that creates a problem. Those numbers really surprised me. And the acceleration, I guess the third and final thing, would be the acceleration of the decline. So, you know, there's been 4 years in the last 10 where there's been double-digit decreases in revenues in the newspaper industry. And three of those years were the last 3 years. And this year, 2016, will be a fourth of five of the last 11 years. So it's getting worse and it's spreading. The community newspapers were fine till 2012, and they've been going down since 2012. Television was doing fine. Television's been going down. All those things kind of caught me a little off guard.
Okay. The report's about a little more than 100 pages long. Someone said to me, it's about 100 pages long, but everyone's going to go to the recommendations at the end anyway.
Is that what we're doing?
Oh, well, that's what we're going to do right now, yes. So, you guessed. There are 12 altogether at the end. I guess I'd wonder, how much, in your view, is this a package of 12 recommendations, and how much, if a government decided to want to do anything, it could pick and choose among them?
Well, I think some of them, I mean, it's a good question. Let me sort of say that several of them are, to me, you know, I've ever been careful ever since the pipeline debates in Keystone not to use the phrase no-brainer, but several of them strike me as no-brainers. I mean, that Canadian companies are charged GST on the sales of advertising and subscriptions, but that foreign companies are not charged that, well, fixing that strikes me as a no-brainer. You know, that's a remnant of the pre-digital world, and 20 to 30 countries have addressed that already. And, you know, that Canadian companies should be operating at a disadvantage, no-brainer. That philanthropy is supporting journalism, and particularly, you know, upstart journalistic enterprises in many countries. But in Canada, the rules are extremely cloudy and uncertain. And it puts a chill on this. Fixing that, you know, strikes me as a no-brainer. I think that there's a seamlessness to what I think is kind of at the core of the heart of the report. The challenge that we have, and Alan presented this challenge through the public opinion research, really, and it showed that the Canadian public has the same view of the role of news and democracy that we as journalists have always had, and that is that news is very important to democracy. It's essential. It's woven together in their minds. But because, and they hold journalists in very high esteem, as we all hold ourselves in high esteem too, in such high esteem that they didn't, and I don't want to steal any of Alan's you know, analysis that he's going to offer, but in such high esteem that Alan says in the report, that they're very suspicious of anything where the government will gain leverage over journalism. So our challenge was, how do you design something that supports journalism without the government gaining undue leverage? And you know, everybody starts from the point of tax credits, and tax credits are seen and thought to be neutral. We didn't see them or think of them as being neutral, and I would just say, you know, you give them to companies that are going to use the money well, and companies going to use the money poorly, equally. They discriminate in favor of larger companies. They tend to. People design ways to get in under it, whether they should be the people who are there or not. And this week we saw a real demonstration of that. You know, the Ontario Media Tax Credit, digital tax credit, grew from under $3 million to over $130 million in 10 years because people designed ways to get in there. And this week, on tax credits, we have, you know, the newspaper industry lobbying the Ontario government to get it back. What we want to get away from is the newspaper industry having to lobby governments, because there's something unhealthy about that. So the core of the report is the Section 19 recommendations, which create a revenue stream. And the revenue stream comes from, in the same spirit as the cable levy that existed for a long time supporting film and television production. The revenue stream exists and comes from the distributors who don't invest in the Canadian journalism system. And they can choose to invest in the Canadian journalism system if they want. It's not based on nationality, which actually would probably be contrary to NAFTA and the WTO. And on the other side, it goes into a fund. And the fund would be, you know, very arm's length. I think if I was tweeting and I said, I would say very, really, or something, in the new spirit of our great tweeter in chief. So you know, it's a very independent entity, and so the money coming in is dedicated. It's not coming from the government; it's coming from the industry. Government has to set up the structure, and it's going out from an arm's length independent study. And I think that's you can't pull that apart.
Okay. Much as I'd like to ask detailed questions about Section 19 and 19.1 of the Income
You and
Tax
I
Act,
both, Chris, yes, that's what we've had in common.
We'll let people read the details of that in the report, because it's a very good, long discussion of it. But what you're talking about is the Journalism Democracy Fund that you would set up, that would then be used to fund a variety of different media ventures. And I've got a few questions about that in a second. But first of all, a bit of an overall philosophical question. If this were to happen, essentially, all Canadian television, all Canadian specialty channels, Canadian magazines, and Canadian news and information would one way or another be subsidized or supported by government-mandated funds of some sort or another. Doesn't that make you more than a little uncomfortable?
Well, in the first way you articulated government, it makes me very uncomfortable. If it's government-mandated, I mean, governments, you know, pass laws. And if the government sort of enables the industry to have this kind of fund, then it doesn't make me uncomfortable at all. If they play in this fund at all, if they have the ability to choose the board of directors, if they have the ability to choose the executives of the fund, the CEO, that would distress me greatly. But this fund is you know, quite frankly, more independent than the in a structural sense than the CBC. I mean, the board of directors of CBC is chosen by whoever's in the government of Canada at the time. I believe the president of CBC is not chosen by the board, but by chosen the government of this time.
True.
You know, this is a structure that's used by the Canadian Foundation for Innovation, and it's a sort of double arm's length type structure, and the government wouldn't be involved in those decisions. So it
we have all forms of media that are subsidized one way or another by some form of taxpayer or something.
I guess that's
like that.
The sadness of being a country of 35 million people, close to a much larger country in a global kind of environment, and it gets exacerbated. I mean, newspapers, you know, as we know, have been a very healthy business. They've been the exception of the rule in you know, the so-called cultural industries. But, you know, that's not so anymore. They're the new film in some ways. And it's not so particularly in the digital world. I mean, the digital world, the economics of digital are that each unit of advertising gets worth less and less every year. You've got to play to a scale that takes you, you know, if you're trying to do Canada, maybe get away with it and make money, but it's pretty darn hard. If you're trying to do Saskatchewan, if you're trying to do Winnipeg, you know, it's very hard in the digital world. It's impossible in the digital world to make money. People, you know, very few assets in the media world people will pay for. You know, that's not really much a model. We kept going, how are we going to finance journalism? Who's going to finance journalism? So the reader isn't really financing journalism, with some exceptions. The advertiser is no longer financing journalism. There's only so many benevolent billionaires to go around. There's not even that many billionaires, let alone benevolent ones out there. And, you know, we started going, okay, philanthropy, that's a source, but not a huge source, but it would make a difference. And, you know, there'll have to be a system that would be, as I said, set up by the public, but not not run by the public.
Three quick last questions, then we're going to turn it over to Alan. The Journalism and Democracy Fund you want to set up, it has a whole series of different things you're proposing that it do. Do you see this as being a permanent institution, or is it more of a transitory one that allows media to exist and move from what it is now to some sort of a digital future, a future that's different than what it is at the moment?
You know, I've been told a number of times over the last few months that one of the things you can't know is how the future is going to unfold. And I'd say that, you know, for people who are kind of saying, who are in the tax credit side of the argument and saying what we need is a five-year transition, I'd say, you know, we would have asked for that in 2011. And we'd be back at the table asking for it now. And we don't know what we're going to ask for in 2022 or need in 2022. So I want a fund that actually is sustainable. Whether it should be ongoing or not, I suppose, depends on how the future unfolds and if somebody comes up with a better answer than we've managed to come up with so far.
Anyone, and I know lots of people in this room, will know the history of royal commissions, inquiries, commons investigations, Senate committee investigations, looking at the media year after year after year, none of which has produced anything other than lots of great paper and maybe some good hearings, but certainly not much in the way of government decision-making or government activity. Do you have any confidence that it might be different this time?
I almost got fired from the Regina Leader Post for writing an op-ed endorsing the Kent Commission, which was very against the Armadale papers in those days. So,
right.
So I know the history of that a little bit. You know, I put myself on the line and they didn't even come through. You know, I was very mindful that this was, you know, as I said at the outset, this wasn't commissioned by the government, but, you know, at the behest of the government, we went down that road. It's an independent study, and we had other sponsors of the study besides the government. I've been in touch with people in the industry and people in government throughout the piece. We've tried to come up with ideological ideas, but we've tried to come up with pragmatic solutions. I see a government that is concerned about the issue. They were concerned about the issue just watching the economic decline of the media. And then after the November election, you know, we had started in June and July talking about filter bubbles and things of that sort. But after the election, the government's very seized by, you know, how fake news can pollute a good and strong information system. Against that, of course, you know, governments have a lot of issues on the table. And our intent here is to help, you know, upgrade, super test this kind of debate and raise it up. I think the government's ready to hear it. I think you'll hear from Alan that the public is not as ready for the government, and the industry's got some work probably to do there.
Okay. On that note, why don't we turn it over to Alan?
Thanks, Chris. I'm obviously delighted to be here today and to be part of this exciting and important project, but I have to confess that when Ed initially approached me, I was a little dubious. I was really worried that maybe he wanted me to do this not because he thought I was a fine researcher, but for the lion's share of my professional life, I had appeared on media. And I don't raise that prospect out of vanity. In fact, anyone who's spent any time on the media will know that it's often an exercise in humiliation. But as a researcher, I've always been fascinated by the media, especially television, how it works, its impact, how it engages an audience. There's no question that it's a very powerful medium. It has the ability to create a sense of intimacy and familiarity. I was constantly struck at how comfortable people were coming up to me, talking to me, engaging me in conversation, writing me long letters about their point of view on a particular point of view. But once you get past that first giddy blush that you're part of something that is powerful, and you really come to realize how the medium works. I had a show on TVO for 19 years, a talk show that I thought was kind of the most high-minded conversation that you could hear on television. And I got one of these letters very, very early on in my career. And it said, "Dear Mr. Gregg, I'm writing you with regard to a recent conversation you had with evolutionary paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould concerning his theory of disequilibrium in the Jurassic period. My question for you is this. What's with your hair?" Now, we're not here to talk about the travails of appearing on television. We're here to talk about news and democracy. And what is the consumer's response? The people who read, people who listen, the people who watch, to the conundrum that everyone in this room is engaged in. We went about doing that. By conducting a two-tiered series of research. The first was six focus groups that we conducted in Montreal in the French language, in Toronto, and Regina in the late summer, early fall. Two of those groups were conducted in each market. One consisted of just general adult Canadians, and the other of what we called involved Canadians. These are people who would write letters to their editor, who would try to convince other people of their point of view, who would be involved in political campaigns and what have you. A little bit more articulate, a little bit more engaged in civic functions. And then we followed that up with an online survey of slightly over 1,500 adult Canadians conducted between June 22nd and October 2nd of the fall. Survey took about approximately 16 minutes to complete, so it was a fairly comprehensive piece of research. First, just in terms of news consumption, virtually everyone follows news at least somewhat closely, but only about a quarter follow news very closely. You can see that there is an age skew to this, but it's an interesting one. There's usually virtually no difference in how much news people consume until they get to be about the age of 55. Then it starts going up quite sharply. Go figure, eh? Education, however, is a strong driver. The better educated, the more news that the individual is going to consume. And they also understand that and value civic journalism and are able to distinguish the importance of different kinds of news they might consume over the course of any given time. You can see here, kind of again in rank order, at the bottom, the dark green, is the number of people who believe that this aspect of news is very important, light green somewhat important, and diminishing up at the top. And you can see current affairs, news about your community, and politics all have, you know, upwards of 90-85% of the population saying that these are either very or somewhat important. That falls off dramatically for sports, entertainment, then we get down to celebrities, notwithstanding the fascination, only 19% are saying. But so there is an ability on the part of the consumer to differentiate. When we ask people, what news, where did they get their news from yesterday? You can see again, barely, the two are almost on top of each other, but for the first time I've seen more people access news online than versus television. 62% versus 61%. For television. This is on the farthest left-hand side. When you break that down by age, you can see again the dramatic increase in television consumption as age goes up, and that you can see conversely among the youngest cohort how much higher online consumption of news is than any other medium available and how that goes down. But that still, even at those aged over 65 years of age, you can see that virtually half of them are getting their news yesterday online. That education and region doesn't have as much of the same kind of impact and probably isn't as worthy of note. The other thing we see is that people are accessing media through multiple sources. In fact, only 63% are using more than one source to get their news yesterday. Only 34% are just using one. Again, we see an age skew there. Those who are under the age of 45 basically are most likely to only use one source, and this one source is disproportionately online. Again, correlating with overall consumption, you see a strong correlation there between number of sources used and education. The better educated you are, the more likely you are to use multiple sources. Reflecting the what Ed and Chris were talking about here, the decline in newspaper readership. We see some quite dramatic numbers here. Only 22% of the population claims to have a newspaper subscription at this point in time. Of that group in the next box, the if yes, half have a print only. This means 11% of adult Canadians have a print only newspaper subscription. An additional fairly strong group, 34%, have both a digital and a print, but even taken together, that means that only 16% of the population has access to a print newspaper subscription. If you drop down one among the larger group, almost 80% who do not have a subscription, fully half of them used to. Basically, 40% of all Canadians had a newspaper subscription and no longer do. Those who are under 40, virtually none of them have ever had a subscription. So if you look at those who are only 40, that number is over 60% of Canadians who are over the age of 40 years old who have basically exited subscription status. Where do people get their online news? This is interesting and telling, and I'm going to come back to this, that the dominant source for all the lament about the legacy media, the traditional media, is that they're getting it from their websites. That said, you see also, again, the myriad, the diversity of sources that that people are using. 54% got their online news yesterday on a social media site like Facebook. Slightly fewer, 46%, are getting on a digital-only site like Reddit or HuffingPost or iPolitics. Much smaller group, 12%, are getting it through emails from friends or family or colleagues. When they use online consumption, the plurality, some 40%, are using a desktop or laptop, but a big section, 24% now, are accessing only on mobile, a quarter of the population, and 36% are using both their laptop and mobile. Put another way, when you add the blue and the gray together, 60% of Canadians are now accessing news on a mobile device, and that most are specifically looking for something rather than just saw it doing something else, although that still is a fairly sizable minority of almost 40% who are just kind of willy-nilly randomly coming across news. While that dominant tendency is to actively seek out news, again, you can see among young people that isn't the case. 51% of those under the age of 34 are coming across their news basically by accident. The older people get, the more likely they are to deliberately seek out news, similarly based on educational status. Higher the level of education, the more deliberate they are in finding the news. Surprising to some, we ask, is the news that is available on television, newspapers, and magazines identical, similar, or different than the news that is available online? Two-thirds, 67%, say it's similar. Only 15% say it's different, and similarly, only 9% say it's absolutely identical. When we shift that over and say, would you say that the professionalism and objectivity of the people who write and produce news stories for media like television, newspapers, and magazines is significantly better, somewhat better, the same, somewhat worse, or significantly worse than the professionalism and objectivity of the people who write and produce news stories exclusively for online, the plurality say that's also the same. Now, a significantly larger group, 38% there, say it's better than the smaller group, 18% who say it's worse or don't know. But the general sense is that the news that is available online is pretty much the same. And the reason it is because it is. They're getting it off the websites of the traditional media, by and large. So in a perverse way, the traditional media has legitimized the authority of the digital space by going there and dominating it. That said, trust in news is very different based on the medium that is employed. You can see again the traditional media, and I don't say that disparaging, just for sake of description, television, radio, television, newspaper, magazines, websites, and newspapers and magazines, again, significantly higher levels of trust, almost 70% saying that they completely trust or mostly trust. Interestingly, importantly, younger people much lower than the average, for traditional media. When you drop down to the last three, the kind of news that you receive via email on social media or sent to you by a friend on social media, you can see again there's very, very little trust, lots of dubiousness around that. Even in the middle, from digital-only sites like, again, Reddington, HuffingPost, and iPolitics, only 34% of consumers say that they completely or mostly trust news coming from those sources. The subtrends that are under here, as I suggest, is that the young are much less trustful in traditional media, the older, much less trustful in the digital-only services, but all, there's virtually no age differentiation in the absence of trust in the information that's coming through the social media and digital sites. The long and short here is that, you know, as traditional media seeks to find out, you know, what is it that we can establish as value in our product offering against all the other stuff that's out there, it's authority. The authority to speak as professional journalists. And again, we'll come back to this theme. We also wanted to get a little bit more context and added a number of questions, and I apologize for the mice type here, but I'll just go through a couple. At the top, the statement that we're at that got the highest level of agreement, 50% totally, 57% totally agreeing, and another 36% agreeing somewhat. That's virtually anyone. If I put a poll in the field that said, today is Thursday, we wouldn't get this many people agreeing. This is virtual unanimity. And the statement is, we get more news more quickly and frequently today than we ever have in the past. Second highest level of agreement, on the other side of the coin, a lot of bogus and untrue news and information appears online. Again, an acknowledgement and recognition, and it follows right from the trust. The first, though, is important, because to say news is imperiled, when people say I have more news more frequently, in more abundancy and in more diversity than I ever have before, is not only counterintuitive, it runs completely contrary to their experience. They are inundated with news, some of it bogus, largely they know where that stuff comes from. And also, if you drop down towards the bottom, with 58% agreement and 43% agreement, you have people agreeing that a day will come when we get all our news online. And nothing would change for me if online news and social media replaced newspapers and local television. And I'll come back to this kind of apparent contradiction also, because I think there's evidence that gives some color to that. Moving into the larger picture, and Ed touched on this, is that there is widespread understanding that news and journalists play a central role in democracy. And this isn't just yay saying, which we sometimes see in polls, people are not having thought about something much, just kind of agreeing for the sake of agreement. We saw this in spades in the focus groups. And they understand that linkage both at the individual level. We had people saying, the news gives me the kind of information and perspective I need to protect my rights and to participate as a citizen. And also at a societal level. They understand that the news holds the powerful to account, who left to their own devices and absent news would probably do worse than they do in the presence of news. So there's a very, very strong linkage. I mean, it's not something that's top of mind. People aren't walking around saying, boy, I'm glad that CBC News is protecting democracy today. But all you have to do is ask, and it comes out in great volumes. And that they also differentiate how important different sources or platforms for news are, again, in protecting democracy. All of them, to some degree, are seen to have some kind of role in democracy, but the dominant ones, again, are the traditional media of television, newspaper, and magazine websites, newspapers and magazines, to a slightly lesser extent, on radio, and then it starts declining from the digital-only platforms, on social media, and again, news received via email. But interestingly, it's not just reported importance to democracy. There's actual evidence that the more people consume news, the more they behave in a civil and civic kind of way. And you can see this right now. Here we're looking at people who are watching the news very closely, somewhat closely, not very closely, or not at all, and whether they donated to a charity, whether they volunteered, whether they tried to convince other people of their points of view, and whether they've ever been involved in a campaign. And you can see in every instance, the more news that is consumed, the more likely they are to exhibit those kinds of behavior. You see the same kind of pattern, but in a lesser form, with newspaper subscriptions, which we've seen are going the way of the dodo bird. But again, if you have a newspaper subscription, you're twice as likely to have donated to a charity, about 40% more likely to volunteer to a charity. No difference in terms of trying to persuade other people to your point of view, unlike gross media consumption, which is very interesting. But again, almost doubling the involvement of working in campaign. Other than this weaker correlation, however, how you access news yesterday has no bearing on civic engagement. The amount you have has a tremendous influence. Therefore, it's the content and presence of news, not the platform where news appears or is accessed, that is important to democracy. And in that regard, I mean, the consumer is relatively agnostic. Another part of the puzzle is that, notwithstanding all the debate around here and all the debate around the Heritage Committee and in Parliament, only half of the total population have ever heard, read, or seen anything about news gathering organizations being in financial difficulty. Of those who have, they disproportionately associate it with newspapers, 68%. And of those who have, 57% believe that this is a serious problem versus 28% who don't. But again, 57% of only 50% of the population is only 25% of the population. About 30% of the population have heard of this and think it's a problem. So you got 70% of the population who is completely and utterly unengaged, notwithstanding all of these great views about trust, about the importance of the reliance to democracy. Well, what contributes to these financial difficulties? And basically, the response is that these knuckleheads continue to put the stuff in print. They're losing advertisers to digital platforms. Readers prefer to get their news from digital platforms. People do not want to pay to get their news online. Significantly less attributed contribution to the cost of paying journalists is too expensive compared to those who write and produce stories for online only. And again, we'll come back to that, all right. Well, what would happen if would result in the decline of news gathering organizations? You can see a massive list of really bad things. Really bad things to not only news gathering organizations, but to citizens. Citizens being less informed, able to protect their rights, no one would be around to keep politicians honest, powerful interests would be less accountable. This again, you know, you've got upwards right across the board between three quarters and a solid majorities saying these would be serious problems encountered. Like the threat to the democracy, these are all, again, you would assume, very bad things. So why no hue and cry? We know in part because 70% of the population doesn't know anything about this. But there's also evidence to suggest that they also do not accept the fundamental premise that the industry is putting forward. That is that no more news gathering organizations would be no more news. They assume, much like dancers will always dance, painters will always paint, journalists will always cover stories. And so they make no linkage whatsoever to the absence of revenue to news gathering organizations with the inability to pay journalists. None whatsoever. And so the argument, needless to say, doesn't particularly resonate. And so we ask, we say, because of the business and financial difficulties facing this is print news, do you think there's a role for government to step in and somehow help them out, very generically? To which the answer is, by and large, either I don't know or no. Only 25% of the population supporting that. And so we look at a basket of public policy responses that Ed wanted to consider. And again, and I won't go through all the difference, but it's things like a cable-like fund supported by foreign platforms, allowing advertisers to deduct costs, tax credits to employ journalists, extend the CBC mandate and funding, a list of 11 different policy options. Not one of them do we find a majority of the population saying that's a good idea. Six of them, there are more people that I say it's a good idea than a bad idea, but the other five, you have more people saying it's a bad idea or a so-so idea than it is a good idea. And there's a real perversity to this, and Ed touched on it. And the reason for that this reluctance isn't just because Canadians are cheap and don't want to see taxpayers' dollar extended to private sector entities. Because what you see right up at the top here If governments provided more support to news-gathering organizations, I would worry that this might affect the way they covered news about government. So it is the very thing they value most about news and its role in democracy, especially holding the powerful to account, that forms the objection to government doing anything to get the industry out of the dilemma it obviously faces. So, what do we know? First, we know there's a big public opinion conundrum. Canadians feel they are inundated with news, yet fewer than half, which is kind of ironic, they're inundated with news, yet only half of them have heard, read, or seen anything about news organizations facing business and financial difficulties. Therefore, the notion that news is in peril is A, counterintuitive, B, runs contrary to actual consumer experience, and C, is not part of public consciousness. That is hardly a prescription for a political dynamic. Basically, they're not engaged with this issue, and that there's no political pressure to change coming from your readers, your viewers, and your listeners. The story so far is that the inundation unquestionably relates to the changing way Canadians are consuming the news, which we've seen, and that additionally a generational divide is driving this change. It's not going to stop. We will be all digital, all platform in our lifetimes. There's no question about that if you just look at the demographic cohort. By and large, Canadians believe that news is available on non-digital media is similar, and a plurality believe that the professionalism and objectivity of journalism is the same as available as online. And the reason for this is probably a little bit surprising, but also obvious. And that is 7 out of 10 online media are getting their news from traditional websites. So they are the same. That said, consumers are also fully aware that a lot of bogus and untrue news and information appears online. This, again, is the authority advantage that that traditional media has. In peril, traditional sources of news continue to be accorded significantly higher levels of trust and authority than the non-traditional digital-only news and social and news carried on social media. And the pattern also here suggests that it's the source and not the platform or channel that confirms trust and authority. The other obvious advantage of speed and cost enjoyed by digital, and then you see it's not a very small wonder that traditional news media is facing shrinking audience. They can get everything they think they can get through traditional media, and the other stuff is free and I can get it faster and whenever I want it. What is the value proposition? The big picture, Canadians do overwhelmingly value civic journalism and believe it plays a major role in democracy at both the individual level and at the societal level, as I related before. Moreover, any threat to democracy is to seem much greater if there's no news emanating from traditional news media sources than digital-only news generators. Our research also indicates that there's a direct correlation between news consumption and democratic behavior, such as volunteering, donating, engaging with fellow citizens in civic discourse. However, it appears that civil involvement is driven much more by how closely one follows the news and the volume of news consumed than the media through which the news is obtained. The one exception being, again, not as strong as news consumption or the amount of news is, again, having a print subscription. Therefore, the threat to democracy, to the extent that it exists, comes not so much from a shift to digital news, but from the prospect of less legitimate news being available. As the story unfolds, when forced to consider the prospect of declining Canadian news organizations, consumers associated a number of negative consequences, including less informed citizens, public accountability, and political honesty. At bottom, however, most believe that a day will come when they'll get all their news online, and for almost half of the population, when that day arrives, nothing would change for me if online and digital news replaces newspaper and local television. The picture that emerges, therefore, is a population that is both relatively unaware and largely indifferent to the plight of traditional media. At the same time, they associate negative consequences to their prospective demise. Well, that's a complete contradiction in terms. That those conflicting impulses suggest to me two things. One, the public either hasn't internalized this stuff, that is, they haven't really come to grips and haven't started thinking about the demise of news gathering organizations, what it means to me as an informed citizen, or they simply reject the premise that a declining news gathering organization would result in a decline in the availability of news. One of the two. Either one, it obviously has to be fixed if you're going to be able to tap into the vein of positive public opinion rather than the indifferent and unaware stuff. With Ergoas, public opinion, the fact of the matter is, does not provide a ready or easy answer to the conundrum posed at the start of this narrative. It isn't. Canadians value news and see news as a pillar of our democracy. Its existence informs their views and influences the behavior of both citizens and authority. They do not know much about any threat to news gathering organizations, and their experience largely of accessing these traditional sources digitally runs contrary to the notion that news is in peril. Basically, they reject the basic premise upon which a case could be made to support traditional news gatherers, namely that their demise would lead to the demise of news and the diminution of democracy. Audience seem to accept that content has value and that labor could be paid for their efforts, but because of the free culture of the internet, including digital news, just not by them. Canadians are also enthusiastic about direct government or public policy support for the sector. Perversely, it's the very things that the public values most about news that seems at the foundation of this resistance. As we saw, pluralities are begrudging to consider things like a SOCAN-like royalty for content users, or a fund kind of like the cable industry. But even these are not policy changes that the population would advocate or champion. This similarly would be an uphill run. And in conclusion, therefore, the industry clearly needs to educate audiences if it wishes to change the public opinion environment. But it also needs to explore new business models that would preserve those aspects of their operations that the public values most, civic journalism and authority in civic journalism. That marshals the case that journalists can only work if there's revenue to pay them. Again, clearly something very important an organization like the Canadian Journalism Foundation could be at work with. And finally, just has to take into account consumer preferences into these models. The consumer is not going to change to accommodate the industry's business models. The industry's business models are going to have to change to accommodate the consumer. As my father was fond of telling me when I was growing up, you know, if that was easy, someone else would do it, wouldn't they? Thank you very much.
Now, before we turn it over to you, I'm going to spend a couple of minutes with April to talk about one aspect of what both Alan and Ed have talked about, which is local news and what's going on the local level. A lot of those issues that are highlighted is in the opinion survey about the things that people say they care about and they say that they're interested in and they think are important. So, April, why don't you tell everyone a little bit about the research that you've been doing and where it's headed, and
sure.
We'll go from there.
Sure. Well, I was really interested in a couple of the main points that you were making, Alan. Well, to start with, off the top. Well, first of all, the people talking about how important news was for democracy. And one of the projects that we were looking at was the amount of political information, local political coverage there was of the 2015 election. And we looked at 8 communities across the country. And what we found when we looked at the local media and what they did in terms of coverage was there's a huge and uneven availability of local news. So people care about it as an input for democracy. They see it as, they recognize it as important. But in fact, where you live is a big factor in the amount of local news that you have access to during a major political event like the election in 2015. So we found, for instance, in a place like Brampton, when we looked at the number of amount of local coverage in the ridings we examined there, people had access to about 2 local stories about the local race for Member of Parliament per 10,000 registered voters. If you went to a place like Kamloops, it was as much as 25 stories for every 10,000 voters. So that there's this real unevenness in the availability of civic and political information, which people said they valued in your work, and also in terms of being informed as participants in democracy. So I thought that was a pretty important connection between the research, and I was interested to see that play out at the local level in some hard numbers. And the other point I just thought I'd mention,
sure,
had to do with this idea of do people care or understand what's going on with local news? And we were interested to try and promote a dialogue about this when we launched, I'm working with a researcher at UBC, John Corbett. We created the local news map, which is a crowdsourced map that allows people in communities across the country to go onto the map and add information about what's going on with the local news sources in their communities. So has a new one been launched? Has a new one has something closed? Has there been a reduction in the service available? Is there an increase in the service available? And our goal with this map was in part to promote a discussion and to make people aware. When you get its visual picture of, when you take a look at the map initially, one of the things that's striking about it are the number of red X's, which represent closures. So that we thought would be one way of having a visual impact and perhaps sparking this dialogue about what's going on with news and whether people care about it and what's happening in their community. The other reason we did the map was we wanted to try and get some data on a national scale as to what's happening at the local level. And what we found was that last time we checked the data on January 3rd, was that there are 305 markers on the map telling us about things that have happened going back to 2008, and 171 of them were closures in 138 communities. So that sort of data, and it changes constantly as people add and we edit and moderate the map. But that sort of data, I think, may be part of addressing that your final point about mm-hmm. the need to get people talking about the role of local news and its importance in communities.
And in that work that you do, and looking at local news poverty, and particularly with people self-identifying problems going on in their communities, how do they break that down, or do they, between newspapers, radio, television? Or do they do much, or do they just identify as there used to be more news and there isn't as
well,
much now?
Well, the map just records the events, so right. What happened. But what we're seeing is that there's a lot of closures are happening in the community newspapers, so papers that are publishing four times or less per week. So I think about 120 of the 171 closures were community newspapers across the country. The other thing we found that's interesting that the data have suggested to us is that this idea that digital first news organizations are going to spring up and fill in the gaps, we're not seeing that, at least we're not seeing that represented on the map. And it's granted we may be not capturing it, maybe people aren't adding that information, but the trend is so significant that I think it's not materializing as a really powerful source. So of the 51 new news sources, local news sources that people have put on the map, only 18 of them are digital first online news organizations. So there probably are more out there that need to be added, but I think there's a sort of an overall trend there that speaks to some concerns about that not being the immediate and easy solution.
One of the things I think some of your research is trying to do or trying to head towards is some sort of sense of, are there any common characteristics of what these communities are like that might be either have what you describe as local news poverty or be main potential victims of that at some point if they're not there yet. So what have you been able to find out and what have you concluded so far about common characteristics, or are there any?
Well, actually, that's where we're headed with this research, is we have, we've looked at these eight communities and we're using the election coverage of the local race for MPs as a proxy for how healthy the local news environment is. And we're going to try and create an index so we can rank these communities as to the ones that seem to be suffering from what we call local news poverty the most and the others that are doing relatively okay by comparison. And once we've identified the ones that are having trouble, and I think we can predict from what our data is showing us already that it's suburban municipalities like Oakville and Brampton, and rural municipalities like the city of Kawartha Lakes out near Peterborough, are three that are really suffering from access, didn't get much local news about the race for Member of Parliament in their area. So our question then is, well, what's going on there?
Local newspapers or local media have closed down, or is it just because they're not doing what they used to do, or are they swamped by metropolitan
Well, that's
area.
What we're that's the question we're going to ask, because in some cases there aren't very many local news outlets. So in Brampton there's basically one that does most of the heavy lifting in terms of providing 42 out of 43 stories were provided by the Brampton Guardian. So that's one of the question is, well, why are some of these communities so poorly served? And there's a number of ideas that we're going to look at, and we know from research in other jurisdictions that income is a big factor. Some research that was done in the States, in the state of New Jersey, where they looked at three different kinds of communities, found that the most affluent community had the most widest range of local news sources and the most stories that were addressing their what they called critical information needs. So income
could be a factor. Because there's still advertisers interested in reaching people, or?
Well, I think there's a whole bunch of factors. I mean, yes, advertising, businesses that have an affluent audience that they can reach. And there's also some suggestion that even when it comes to starting a local news organization, if you have a lot of people who are retired with pretty decent incomes, they can take a flyer and give it a try. Whereas
in terms of willing to you mean to start it up themselves
as a startup,
not as subscribers.
No, as a startup. Right. So those are sort of factors that could come into play. The presence of a local newspaper might also be something to look at, because some work in Europe that's been done has suggested that local newspapers, they aren't the go-to number one place that people go to anymore as their first source of news. They actually have a big impact on the availability of news in communities, because other news organizations look to them and, you know, rip and read if they're at the radio station, or for civic news in particular, political news in particular.
Okay, one last question, and then we're going to open the microphones for people to ask, and that's, this is leading to a project coming up in June that Ryerson's involved in. So I'll let you do a quick plug for that.
Oh, great. Free advertising. So on June 3rd and 4th, we're going to be doing a conference on the future of local news. And so we've sent out requests for proposals, and we've received about 50 proposals for different types of presentations from scholars and other people around the world who want to talk about research, that state-of-the-art research that's happening in terms of what's going on at local news in different jurisdictions. So we've got some research out of the States, the UK, and other places as well.
Okay, great. Now this is a chance for you to ask questions. We have a microphone in the center. And I would only ask three things. Number one, that you please identify yourself. Number two, remember that we're asking questions. And it's always good to have questions. And number three, that if you direct it to one person in the panel, please. And then if the other members of the panel are interested in responding, they can as well. So our first questioner is...
Hi, Michael Valpy. Alan, have you drilled down any deeper into this absence of a link in people's minds between the essentialness of news but the refusal to pay journalists as to why it happens? I teach at University of Toronto in media studies, and I cannot get my students to make the connection. They see the need, but they insist that news has to be free.
Well,
And the other thing is this an age specific disconnect, or right through the population?
It's clearly skewed young. That propensity, but I think there's a number of things. I mean, first, you have within the internet a culture of free. Anyway, thing one. Thing two is that most people will pay for something, but they won't pay for it if they think they can get exactly the same thing for free. And that's part of their thinking right now, is that they can get the exact same thing. The absence of a linkage between the notion that someone must pay, and you can see that they're not enthusiastic, but they're saying that, okay, maybe Google should pay, because if they're using someone else's content, because clearly that does have value. But they don't make any linkage that would actually, you know, be a means through which news gathering organizations could continue to gather the news, because they would have journalists who would have a paycheck. So I don't know how you really explore the absence of a linkage. I think what you have to do is you have to provide a linkage there, just knowing that it's not there. And, you know, organizations like journalism schools, like journalists, the Journalism Foundation, that news gathering organizations, we can see that people hold journalists in tremendously high regard. I mean, you have to start advocating for yourself. If no one appreciated, you know, what nurses were doing, I mean, do you think they would just kind of quietly say, oh, rats? You know, they'd be out there working it.
I'd add two things, Michael. One, when we were in the focus groups, it was very interesting to see the pervasiveness of this culture of free. People would say often, where do you get your news is one of the early questions in the focus groups, and people would say, well, I follow news on Facebook. Quite and often they would say that. And then there'd be kind of a pause after people spoke about that for a minute, and they'd say, except if it's really important. And so the moderator would say, well, what happens when it's really important? Well, I don't really trust Facebook or my friends for something that's really important. When it's really important, and this is important to them, I prefer to go to. And I would not say that they used the phrase trusted news sources, because they didn't. They would name news papers in their neighborhood. They would name journalists who they recognized. They would name anchors on national newscasts. They would name people like that who they trust, who they want. Then the moderator would ask them about paying, and they would go, you know, I really know I should, but I'm not going to pay. And they'd feel, I think, a little bit guilty about it, but not too guilty. That was their culture.
The other thing I'd add from seeing a couple of the focus groups is there is absolutely no understanding of how news happens.
No.
And no understanding of where the money comes from to actually pay for it. And that is part of a significant part of the problem.
Well, and to April's point, last point April made was you know, communities that have newspapers have a greater feedstock into the ecosystem in that community. And you know, this was for us a critical question. We live in the paradoxical world in which there's more news, as Alan describes, access to more news than ever before, and news and opinion, and things that spring off news. But the crisis that exists is in origination news. And we have, you know, more and more pressure on the origination. There is so little research that exists on this, and no research in Canada that I've been able to identify. But Pew did some fascinating stuff in 2009 and 2015 in a couple of American cities, where they'd study the ecosystem for 4 or 5 days, everything that moved in that ecosystem. And in 2015 in Denver, I think the number was 75% of the news was still originating in traditional media. And what we're calling civic function news was disproportionately originating in the now almost destroyed Denver Post.
Just one last point on that, Michael. I mean, there, you know, while it might be infuriating, there's a certain logic to the consumer's point of view. They're saying, I've got more news now than I ever have before, and I don't pay a penny for it. So how could there be a problem?
Just a final observation. When I took my class down to the Globe and Mail to meet with David Walmsley, there he is, this subject came up, and you said, you know, our problem...
Michael, speak to the microphone so we can hear you.
Yes, sorry. And I took my class down to the Globe to meet with David Walmsley, and David, you said that what we've got to do more is tell the public how we do what we do.
Okay, before we go to our next question, April would like to add one thing.
Yeah, I was just going to say, in terms of demonstrating value, one of the things we looked at was in Kamloops, who was producing the local news about coverage of the election. And one of the news organizations was an online site that had been started after the demise of the newspaper called News Kamloops. And it produced about a quarter of all of the election news that out of that community during the month we studied. And that news organization died last fall. So the news organization that was providing people with a quarter of the news reporting is not there anymore. So it may be that we just don't have enough concrete examples that show people why news matters, that might help inform the conversation.
Next question, please.
Hi, my name is Stavros. I run a service called Expertise Finder. I used to be a TV producer. On one hand, it's kind of this obsession talking about revenue, but there's always revenue, and there's this other side that no one wants to talk about in life called expenses. Expenses, like, you know, what cost structure. I'm not sure if this is something, this is a question for Edward. I mean, look at technology. I mean, how many versions of technology has the Toronto Star or the Globe and Mail went through, and something that might cost BuzzFeed $1,000 might cost them $100,000. And you look at things like, I don't know, online, I'm thinking one innovation, like the TAI in British Columbia, tend to be a bit more dynamic. So did you look in that area as part of this study?
The cost structures of
the
organization? Yeah, of course. You know, of course, obviously, traditional media are, you know, burdened by higher cost structures and by legacy pension costs and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I suppose when Chris asked the things that that surprised you, you know, a couple things about the internet and digital-only operations surprised me. I was hopeful that, and the way we structured our questions, the second question was whether digital-only enterprises, news enterprises, would fill the democratic gap if there was indeed a democratic gap opening up. And what I found in Canada is that these operations are very small. You mentioned the TAI. The TAI is an excellent operation. It employs three full-time journalists after 14 years in operation.
I tell the source of funds.
And it's one of the best.
Yeah.
And so that's problematic. There's a number of I guess what I call branch plant operations, some of them contributing well to Canadian journalism, but most of them, you know, with a very thin attachment to our news. So they'll open an Ottawa bureau, they'll close an Ottawa bureau very quickly. So, you know, that's...
That would be Vice and BuzzFeed in both cases.
Could be. Could indeed be. And so that sector, you know, to the point that of the Kamloops example, you know, the co-founder of Vice, Shane Smith, is, you know, saying that this year 30% of digital news operations in the United States are going to go to business in 2017. I mean, this isn't a business model that's working very well either, and particularly not working if you want to create original journalism, despite the cost structures being much lower.
Thank you. Next.
Hi, I'm Susan Reisler. I did read the report. Thank you very much. I think the timing of it is pretty impressive. I think, and maybe I've been over on the public relations side of things for too long. It has been too long, but anyway. I think that in the big recommendation, and the one that can be, I think, discussed and taken at a policy level, is about the taxes. I'm thinking of the context right now. Transparency International, The Star and CBC have been focusing on tax evasion. I think there's an appetite in Canada that people pay their fair share and they understand that they're going to have to be regulations introduced. So if you push ahead on the idea of leveling the playing field with Google and Facebook and adding Netflix into this, because that's already part of the agenda, get rid of this idea that I think is making people uncomfortable, which is setting up a fund, or plural funds, I think that might have some traction. I think the idea that we would have a fund along the lines of the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board or something as complex as that, putting together all of the, you know, the people who run the news organizations in our country is, you know, is another story. But I think there's room to push ahead on the tax issue. And people are talking about that and there's buzz around that. So I guess I'm wondering if you'll just drop some of the things you've said that are more controversial and just grab onto a few things that are quite pitchable and might you could sell.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised to mention the consumption tax issue, the HST, GST, et cetera, tax issue. I wouldn't be totally surprised if we see some movement on that fairly soon. I don't know if it'll be as soon as this budget, but you know, it could be. You know, it's going under the name the Netflix tax, but it's the exact same situation we're talking. And in fact, if you put it in the context of a civic you know, a civic gap in supporting journalistic enterprise, it's a lot easier than saying let's tax the entertainment thing, Netflix. It's a bad name for a government that wants to do something about it. And I, you know, can't speak for Google or Facebook, but I think that they have made very clear that they pay taxes as they are assessed in the countries in which they operate, and they do pay taxes, you know, they do pay sales taxes in the countries in which they operate if those countries actually shift the onus, which is what you have to do, from where the good is sold to where the good is purchased. And that's what's happened in Europe, Australia, Israel, South Africa. We can go on and on.
But to follow up on Susan's question, if you'll let me for a second, but in your report, you're advocating that revenue go into the Journalism and Democracy Fund, right?
Well, actually, not the GST, HST revenue, the revenue that would come under the Section 19 reforms.
Okay. So that would just be general revenue flowing to government to help.
Yes, and it would, you know, to your point of leveling the playing field, well, we want at the very least level the playing field, because it seems perverse to have policy that penalizes Canadian companies investing in journalistic enterprise. But, you know, a number of provinces, including Ontario, have moved, at, perhaps with some lobbying from some people in the front row, I'm not sure, to offer a rebate on the sales tax on newspaper subscriptions. Well, that should exist for digital subscriptions too, and it should exist across the country in that way. So we'd actually wouldn't mind re-unleveling the playing field too.
So, and you'd be willing to sort of focus more on that, and if this other idea of the fund gets to be too controversial and too sticky, we wouldn't spend a lot of time on that.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the questions.
The
fund gets too difficult and too sticky.
It doesn't matter.
If the fund is too problematic to do, is your question essentially, well, is it just to do the tax stuff if you can't do anything else?
Yeah, focus on the tax and not push it ahead to something Alan's research says that there is no appetite to, you know, move over there, and there's only so many battles you can fight at once, so let's start with leveling the playing field.
Yeah, well, you know, that might be easier, and it might be a first step, but I think that the system needs some recycling of that revenue then toward more investment in journalistic excellence, more investment in digital innovation, more capacity for some of these small digital innovators to maybe, you know, get themselves pushed up the hill. You know, we have an initiative that's financed by this fund with Canadian Press to provide more local service across the country. We have an initiative working with the APTN to provide more coverage, because, you know, if you want to talk about a democracy that's not properly covered, we could talk about Indigenous government, Indigenous democracy. And we spoke to a lot of small operators in our round tables who run Treaty 4 News in Saskatchewan and other enterprises across the country like this, and they're one people, two people, at most three people, and they're trying to cover an order of government. So, you know, those are all things as well that we, you know, have this fund financing, as well as a couple of others. So, you know, we think there's good use for that money.
April.
I just think that if you look at some of the work that's been done in the States on trying to foster more healthy local news ecosystems, to use that word, is one of the conclusions they've arrived at is they have to look at a way to build capacity as opposed to subsidize content. And they've been making a real distinction between that, because if you just get into the business of a subsidy so you can hire more journalists, as soon as the subsidy ends or there's pressure to get rid of the subsidy, you're back where you started. So I think the challenge is to be able to work in that area, building capacity, as opposed to subsidizing content production.
Okay, Suan Kelman, retired from teaching journalism at Ryerson. I think that on one hand it's heartening that you didn't encounter the hostility to or distrust of traditional media that I think you would find if you were doing something similar in the States from a substantial minority. But I'm shocked, as I think a lot of people here are, that even people sophisticated enough to read a lot of news think that it falls like manna from the heaven, and that no one has to pay for it, and that no one needs to be paid for producing it. So as you were talking, I was thinking, how do other groups handle this? And I thought of the highly emotive commercials the nurses are running right now. Maybe while we're doing more study, it's time to start running ads to find the money for this. You know, you can allow this adorable young journalist, I'd go with Chris Glover from CBC or Adrian Morrow from The Globe, to keep a roof over his head, or you can close the screen. Can we do anything about our image that people understand that journalists have to be paid? Yeah.
You know, I'm not shocked at all that people don't understand the economics of the business. Most of us who work in the business don't understand the economics of the business either. And one of the things that, you know, and Alan pointed to this, one of the things that that people say is, well, I don't know what's wrong with those newspapers. If they're losing money, they've got these websites, and the websites also have advertising, just like the newspapers have advertising. So why don't they just stop printing the newspaper and go on the website? And do you expect people to actually understand that, you know, the dollars for dimes argument? Why should they? You know, why should they at all? And the industry, and I'm, you know, I suppose guilty of this as anybody. The industry, particularly the newspaper industry, for the last 10 years has tried to say two things at the same time that are completely contradictory. And one they want to say loud and the other they want to whisper. And the one they want to whisper is, we're in trouble here. and the one they want to say out loud is, advertisers, we have more reach than we've ever had before. And we're good, and stick with us. And it's kind of hard to have those two contradictory messages coming at the same time. Are people confused? I'm not surprised.
But to the specifics of your question, it's like the cobbler's children having no shoes. I mean, who has a bigger megaphone than the media industry? Nobody. That's all you have.
Next question.
Hi, I'm Sarah Watson. I'm actually a journalism student at Humber. I'm part of that generation that does not want to pay for news. there is another option that some independent media specifically and some bigger ones have used to supplement their income, and that's crowdfunding. And I was wondering if you thought about that at all. It allows people to pay what they can, when there is sort of, in this younger generation that you're talking about, we may not have the stable income that the older generations have. And do you think that crowdfunding could be a viable income for media?
Do you want me to? I can try a little bit of that. I think where crowdfunding, I think the research that's been done so far would suggest that crowdfunding may work for individual projects. And you can get projects crowdfunded if you want to go and do a certain story or if you want to go to do certain things. Attempts to do crowdfunding to produce what you would call operating income, that would be the long-term income that you would have that would allow you to hire people and be able to assure people that they would have jobs at the end of the year and have jobs next year, is a lot more difficult to come by. There's various processes in the United States. There's an American company called Patreon that runs some of this, that does encourages some crowdfunding projects to make a small donation every month out of your credit card, $5 a month, and it's taken off automatically, some of those things. A website like Canada Land has used that, I think, with a fair amount of success. It's not worked universally for other people. And the challenge is people who put money, often the people who put up money and support things like on a project basis, put up your $20 to help Ed go to Africa to cover a story and we'll send you a t-shirt or we'll send you pictures of what Ed does. That thing does seem to kind of work, but it hasn't worked in Canada, at least broadly enough and on a widespread scale enough, I don't think, for anyone to think that they would make a commitment to many employees to sort of, and even if you look at the people, I mean, the Tai'i has been successful at some of the things it does by creating a charitable foundation that it can do work through. The Walrus has done the same sort of thing, whether it's the Walrus Foundation, which is maybe a more sustainable thing, which relates to one of the report's other recommendations as it relates to charities and charitable foundations.
Yeah, my friends, or they were friends until earlier today when we published the report, in the digital-only business who have crowdsourcing as a major part of their model, think that I perhaps underestimated the sustainability of that as a model. You know, in many ways, it's a circulation model. It's a reader will pay model. It churns every year. You gotta give your credit card again. That means, you know, you gotta resell all your people a year, again every year. I've had this conversation with Jesse Brown at Canada Land, and Jesse feels that this makes him closer to his listeners. And he has a relationship with the listeners. Now, he had a crisis at one point late last year, and he went out and his listeners, you know, put up money to help the crisis. I think that's great. I'm just not sure that you can scale to the kind of journalistic intensity that I would like to see, and the replacement of the loss of journalism through that kind of model alone. We're going to have many kinds of solutions, and it's part of one solution, but it's not a solution in and of itself to me.
April, you're going to add something?
Well, I was just going to say there's also some journalistic considerations to take into account, which is you might have a story that you think's great, but the crowd thinks is really boring and not interesting, when in fact it actually is an important story to tell. So you're kind of at the mercy of the news judgment of the crowd, so to speak.
It's not the same thing, but Ed touched. We did look at charitable giving as part of a financing mechanism, because as you probably know, that if a charitable organization spends more than 10% of its activity in advocacy, it loses its charitable status. So almost by definition, media couldn't be charities. And if you could, you know, if you could loosen that up and actually make or allow media outlets to issue tax receipts? You know, are there philanthropists out there who would say, of all the things that are important to me, democracy and journalism, I look at PBS, a lot of the foundations that support PBS are dedicated to journalism. That's their focus and their mission in America. Unfortunately, in Canada, we just have a much more underdeveloped philanthropic sector than is in America.
One last question, and then as moderator, I'm going to take the opportunity to ask the panel a final question after this one. So go ahead, please.
Hi, my name is Laurent Guérin. I work for TFO. And my question would be related to the music industry. I wouldn't know whom to direct this question, but it seems to me like another category of profession has lived and still lives through this kind of crisis is the musicians and the artists and the composers and writers, started with Napsters and everything. And they would be also saying that, well, nobody wants to pay any more for their content. And even more, they don't have their support, not records or anything that sells anymore at all. The solution hasn't been found yet, but do you see there in the streaming solutions, any encouragements, signs, or leads that we could pursue?
Well, I think there's a lot of parallels. I mean, I see the media industry today kind of the way the music industry was in 2000. You know, clinging to a business model that clearly the consumer had completely rejected, and as a consequence, you know, losing its relationship with the audience. The only part of the music business that really makes money on the music side is live. And that's because you can't download a great live concert and a great live experience. And a lot of the smarter ones, you know, are out there. And first of all, smarter musicians saying, who needs a record label anymore? And they're into free motion. Give away that which is plentiful and charge that which is rare. And so Radiohead did a crowdsourcing thing with one of their records, Pay What You Can. 1.6 million people paid what they can. What they got was not the money that they paid what they can. They got email lists for 1.6 million people who then became their fan base that they invited to shows and rehearsals before. And that kind of thinking, I think, is, you know, is someone once said, you know, the quo has no status. And that's what the media industry looks like to me today. That if they just kind of incrementally try to, you know, bump along and hope something, maybe the consumer will start paying for this. Well, they'll pay for something if they're getting something that they can't get anywhere else. But if you're giving it away to Facebook and Google, who have a business model that says, the only way I make money in Google and Facebook is if I've got a billion users. There's no transaction on Google that's worth more than $250. None. What's a full page in the Globe and Mail? 35,000. Well, is it any wonder you can't make any money? Especially if you're in Saskatchewan, you know.
As Alan will remember, throughout the process, he kept comparing the news business to ballet. And I don't think it was an artistic comment at all, but it was, you know, if the public will support the ballet, why won't the public support news? I'm not sure the public knows that they're supporting ballet. That may be one issue. I kept comparing it to film, and I thought that, you know, news is the new film. If you want to tell Canadian stories, we never had the scale to be able to afford to tell Canadian stories in film, and there had to be other methodologies. In some ways, news is right between ballet and film because film you can scale. You know, we're seeing that today in film and television production, where you can, you know, where you can watch Borgen from Denmark and you'll watch it around the world, and you can scale that. News is both, by definition, tends to be localized and perishable, so it's much harder to, you know, have those kinds of economies.
I think streaming has generated some revenue for artists, but the amount they get is a lot less than they would have under royalties under other circumstances.
Well, and they're having a hard time negotiating with the streaming services about what kind of royalty they should be paying, and it's significantly lower than they ever had to do in the analog world.
Before we wrap up, let me just ask one question to all the panelists, and that it seems to me, and this will probably be a fairly ill-formed question, but I'll try it anyway. There's some parallels with what's happening at the moment and what's being proposed as solutions to what's happened with specialty channel television in Canada. And in that the CRTC dealt with producers rather than consumers and set up a system that decided that rewarded producers, set up various funds, did various things that allowed us to that allowed Canadians to produce a lot of specialty channel television. The end result, though, wasn't millions of Canadians watching specialty channel television. It was people saying, why are we getting all these channels we don't want to pay for? So I guess my question is, what we're all talking about is all very good and positive things. I wonder, is some of it a little bit like eat your vegetables? And you know, the Guelph Mercury, for all the Guelph Mercury was maybe a good newspaper, when it shut down, if my numbers are right, it had 9,000 readers. It used to have 22,000, and Guelph, I think, has been growing rather than shrinking. The thing we haven't talked about much is the audience and the consumers. Where do they fit into all this? We have it somewhat with, is part of the problem that, in fact, the news media is not delivering the information that people actually want? April?
Well, I'll jump in first. Sometimes I think about it as a comparison to widgets. I produce widgets, but I've got some financial problems, so I'm going to take the motor out of the widget. And then I'm going to turn the metal cover into plastic. And now it doesn't work so well, and fewer people are buying it. So I'm going to cut it some more and save some more money. And what is there left to sell? So I think when you get to situations in Guelph and other places, there is an element of there's nothing left for people to engage with. So I think that's part of the problem. Now, where my argument completely collapses is when you have a really vigorous news organization, like, say, the Star's work it's been doing in Toronto and Carding and other stories, and it's also having trouble. So I think that there's the dilemma, is trying to figure out, when you're trying to figure out what the audience wants, yeah, they want great news coverage, and I think they're unhappy when they have a newspaper that or a news organization that isn't supplying it.
And it's part of the problem that the media didn't have to figure that out while the advertisers were there, and they're now having trouble doing that.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a good question, because I mean, I remember having arguments with my friend who is on the National, saying that, you know, if you think that anyone is tuning in to CBC at 10 o'clock to find out what happened today, you're crazy. And if they don't know what happened today, you don't want them, because they're a cretin. and that's all you're doing, is telling them what happened today. Clearly, you have no value. So you better tell them something different that they didn't know and that they can't get from Twitter and their friends and all the other sources that are inundating. I mean, it used to be what you did, the news was what happened today. Well, it's not. It's what happened this second. So you have to redefine what's news.
And yeah, we'll let Ed have the last word as the
redefining what is news. I think, you know, from the time we were both young in the newspaper industry, we've, you know, talked about relevance and what attracts audiences and whether we're kind of just talking to ourselves and talking to our sources and things like that. Then we went off to another extreme in the digital age, in which you can have instant measurement, and we just wanted click, 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 click. How many clicks can you get? Click, click. And we didn't care about loyalty. We didn't care about providing the audience with sustainable issues. You know, one of our most successful days at GlobeandMail.com and during my life at GlobeandMail.com was when the very unfortunate British actress hit her head at Mont Tremblant, and we broke that story, and we were flooded. And we thought, great, well, you know, nobody's coming back. That wasn't building a sustainable model, and clicks wasn't a sustainable model. So I think, yes, we have to figure out how to be relevant. We have to figure out how to be get that balance right and be serious. And particularly, you know, the best model, no doubt the best model is a reader pay model. You mentioned specialty TV. The best model is HBO, and you want to get good coverage from people who really care to pay. It's a hard model for everybody. And the last point I'm going to make about it is not all people are equal. And you can see this. You know, on page 28 of the report, we asked, the public companies, we did the computing ourselves, but the private companies, we said, we know you're not going to give us your revenues, David Thompson and Mr. Demaray, but why don't we do this? Let's say the revenues were 100% in 2011. What are they today? Just let's see what the relative decline has been. And at the top, and I, you know, we're going to leave, we, you know, at the top is Le Devoir, and you should ignore that because Le Devoir is a sort of anomaly because they started with zero advertising, so they took less hit.
Right.
But after that, you have differentiation. And at the bottom, and everybody's got different circumstances. Toronto's a much more competitive media market than Regina is. At the bottom is post-media, and I think it speaks to April's point. Post-media has been burdened by debt and from the beginning, and an ownership structure that may or may not have the same commitment to Canada as other ownership structures. I'll leave that to you to decide. Well, they're the worst performer in terms of in revenue performance of the 10 companies here. I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that, and this is like before debt. This is, you know, your operating profit I'm talking. I'm sorry, this is your revenues. This is well before debt. So you put less back in, you're probably going to get less connection to your community, less connection to your advertisers, et cetera, et cetera. It's just a downward death spiral. How you break that spiral? I think that's what we're trying to address through trying to find ways to enrich the quality of the journalism in the system and the digital innovation in the system.
Thank you. And on behalf of everyone here, thank you very much to all our three panelists, and I'll turn it over to Natalie Kirby.
Thanks, Chris. On behalf of the Foundation, I want to thank Chris Waddell for leading the discussion this evening and for the work he put into the public opinion survey. The CJF is committed to an annual investment in journalism research, and we're thrilled to have shared our stage this evening with the Public Policy Forum in this exciting report on news and democracy with insights from our stellar panel. So please join me in a round of appreciation for all of our speakers. And our thanks to all of you for supporting CJF J-Talks. We have a terrific lineup of speakers this year featuring media thought leaders tackling the challenges facing the industry and exploring some solutions. As well, our awards program is now open, and I would encourage you to have a look. We have awards and fellowships for early and mid-career journalists, fellowships for Indigenous journalists. We have a new internship for investigative journalism with the Globe and Mail, along with our awards celebrating journalistic excellence and lifetime achievement. You can have a look at our website and social media for details on CJF events and awards. I'd like to now invite you, along with our audience in the next room, to join us for the cocktail reception and to continue the conversation. Thank you and have a great evening.